This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician. Did he hit Austin? My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Where I wanna be. All I wanna do is get back to something familiar, to a place where I know I could be me. Tell me if this ain't the place I'll kindly leave. All I wanna do is get back.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, broadcasting in high definition audio, or something quite like it, to all corners of the globe, to fans everywhere huddled over your laptop or other listening device, waiting for all the news coming forth from Trinidad World Recording Studios here, my beautiful studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. Oh, is this summer getting to everybody out there? It sure is to me. My goodness. My goodness. Phil Pritchett here, fans. How you doing? Joining you again after a far too long absence. I have been out of the state, out of the loop, out in the wilderness. But I have returned from the wilderness with the news, and I have stories to tell. Stories to tell, so pull up an old rocking chair there. Fire up the pipe, that corn cob pipe, and grab a bowl of gruel or a cup of coffee and get ready, man. Oh, because I have adventures to tell. I've been up in Colorado. A lot of y'all know I spend a lot of time up there. Every summer, me and the family go up there. My wife and I met years ago as counselors at the Great Blue Mountain Ranch, small family outdoor camp near Woodland Park, Colorado. It's in Florissant, Colorado, just west of Woodland Park, which is all west of Colorado Springs. And boy, oh boy, we were there for a couple weeks this year, and adventurous. I'd like to end a streak. A streak ended up there. I can now say, after years of never having it happen to me, it has finally occurred. The streak is over. Yours truly, Phil Pritchett, is someone who has, quote-unquote, been evacuated. I have been evacuated. Phil, what's talking, man? I'm talking about the wildfires in Colorado. Dude. Oh, man, this is serious business here. Very serious business. Of course, we love going to Colorado. I went there as a kid. Summer camp. I was a counselor up there. Love the fly fishing, rainbow trout, mountains, snow, fires, the trees, the whole thing. Love Colorado. In the summer, of course, it's a heck of a lot cooler than it is. In Texas, it's why we seek it out, right? The cool temperatures. Now, in the summer, you know, July, August, it can get warm, especially down at lower elevations like Colorado Springs and Denver, that are really at the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 feet, whatever they are. But this camp, you know, Blue Mountain, Florissant, Breckenridge, Colorado, a lot of y'all are familiar with the ski resort, which is about an hour west of the camp, northwest of the camp. You know, you're talking about elevations at, you know, 8,000 feet, 9,000 feet, something like that. considerably cooler. Beautiful. Oh, man. And it can get warm, but you usually get these afternoon rains come in, a thunderstorm. And then, man, after that thunderstorm, it can be 54 degrees. You got your jacket on. You're walking around in a moist meadow. The wildflowers coming up. The sun going down. It's just, it's amazing. You grab your fly rod. The wind is calm. Get out there on the pond or the, you know, the beaver pond or the stream. It's what we live for, going up there, for crying out loud. But this year, oh man, not to be. The trouble started, you know, the full band, a lot of y'all downloading that live in Corpus Christi record, man. Thanks so much for doing that. Guys, live albums sell so much faster than the studio things, the studio records, which is understandable. But man, a lot faster. Man, all the studio records are, people just sort of dip their toe into those things. They download a track or two, and the sales and the download and the streams on Spotify are always modest. But these live records, my bestsellers are just cool and unusual. You know, Phil Comes Alive, this Corpus Christi thing's vault into the top of that list. Maybe I'll only put out live records from now on. I'm just kidding. But, of course, on the Corpus Christi live record, our drummer, the venerable Luke Ayers, he went up to Colorado, to Creed, Colorado, also a Colorado guy, fly fisherman, he came back and he was there in early May, mid-May maybe, when it can be very cold still up there in Creed, and he came back and said, man, it's really warm, and I was like, oh, man, what? He goes, yeah, I hadn't had a lot of snow. It's been kind of a dry winter, and, man, it's like 85 degrees up there. I was just like, oh, gosh, because I knew it'd be hot by the time we got up there. And it was quite warm in early June for that part of the country. Warm and windy and bone dry. And by the time we got up there in the Florissant area west of Colorado Springs, they'd already had some fires. The people around, you'd see this, you know, little puffs of smoke in the afternoon. I'd say, oh, man, there's a fire over there. I'd say, well, that one's contained. There was one by Lake George, 11-mile canyon area, that was, you could see the smoke in the afternoons if the winds were high, but it was contained. They're like, oh, they got that one out. And there was, of course, the huge one in northern Colorado near Fort Collins that was raging on at the time. That's a long way from the camp, though. So a little smoke in the air, but that's about it. So after about a week at camp, I spend Father's Day morning in the canyon, man, 11-mile canyon. It's a long, skinny canyon full of huge trout, South Platte River running through there, running out the bottom of 11-mile reservoir. So I go up there, caught some great fish, man, catching fish, crystal clear water. You see them holding in the current, throw everything you got at them, a lot of fly tying, fighting the wind a little bit, but doing well. And man, yours truly, Phil, how you doing? I just start getting a little, my senses out there, heightened in the wilderness, you know, heightened in the wilderness. Man, there's bears and all kinds of stuff in the woods. You got to kind of watch out up there in Colorado. Keep an eye out. Keep your head about yourself. A lot of people fishing in the canyon, camping. Man, I kind of can smell the the wood burning. Smell like the old campfire. But it's a clear day. I'm like, golly, I wonder what that's about. Oh, well, I didn't pay it much attention. Then sure enough, man, right over the hill where I was, I start seeing some gray plumes of smoke, just small. And I think, well, you know, maybe that was the fire from the other day. It's maybe kind of still flaring up a little bit, but they've got that under control. Oh, I'm going to tell you, man, that the day starts to wear on, dude, and I start looking over there, and I just get that feeling in my gut that something's wrong. Although none of the people that walked past me or campers or hikers, no one else seemed to notice or care or be too concerned about it. I'm kind of a worrier by nature anyway, so I'm cautious. So I'm kind of keeping an eye on this plume, man. It's just growing. The smell starts. And I finally just go, man, I don't know what the story is. I'm out of cell phone range really in there. And I just go, man, I'm just going to, the camp's only a couple miles away. I'm just going to head back to camp. Yeah, that's fine. Caught some fish, so I'm getting in my car to roll back out of the canyon, and then here comes the lights on a county vehicle coming up the road in the canyon. Guy rolls down the window and goes, "Hey man, mandatory evacuation from 11-mile canyon." I'm like, "Oh gosh, really? I'm way ahead of you, man." So I jump in there and cruise on out of there. But man, no one else is really leaving. I don't know. I was first one out, man. flooring it back to the camp. And then I get outside the canyon. I look back towards Blue Mountain, for which the camp is named. And, man, this plume of smoke is really growing, man, and just, you know, kicking ass. And I can see that it's closer to the camp than I thought. So I'm driving back. I'm like, oh, my gosh, you got the wife and kids up there. Going to camp, and, man, things are starting to happen, man. There's people loading cars and vans and scurrying around and talking to the directors of the camp. The counselors are like, man, we might have to evacuate. We don't know how close it is or which way it's going. It's a new fire. It just popped up this morning. No one. So, man, this thing's, I mean, you can see it, the smoke. You know, I couldn't see, like, the flames or anything. So, you know, directors of the camp are kind of driving up on the hill. They're like, man, we can see the flames, but they're like, still a mile or a couple miles off or something. There was no, you know, impeding, no clear and present danger, should I say, to the camp right then. But we were all kind of on hold. We said, man, there might be a mandatory evacuation. And, man, sure enough, a few seconds later, sirens going off, everybody out. Everybody head to Woodland Park, the next biggest city east of town. So I'm like, oh, my gosh. And, man, you know, these are little kids, a lot of them. They're upset. They're confused. There's just all sorts of crying and screaming and people getting in the vans. And man, I get kind of caught up in the fray. I mean, I'm just like, all right, let's go. Let's go. You know, I don't want to be the last guy out or anything. So I grab, get the kids in the car, grab a guitar, my guitar, and my computer, and just throw it in the car. We head out. And I'm kind of thinking, all right, we're getting out of the camp, but I go, man, we'll probably go into the Woodland Park for a few hours, wait till we kind of get the fire under control, then we'll all go back. So we get to Woodland Park. Man, we got to go to the Woodland Park High School. And all of a sudden, man, yours truly, Phil here, how you doing, is a refugee, man. I walk into Woodland Park High School. Beautiful high school, by the way, in the beautiful town of Woodland Park. And here come the bottled water, the Red Cross, cots and bottled water, the blankets over the shoulders. Not really, no blankets. But we're just sitting in this empty gym. And it was fun. The kids kind of run around trying to entertain the kids. My wife and I, we kind of help out the camp a little bit. And so the kids are playing basketball and things. But, man, we're trying to get news. You know, we got all the – we've recruited all the kids with iPhones and stuff to kind of say, hey, man, what do we got? What do we got? Oh, man, it's growing. It's 100 acres. And now it's 200 acres. It's growing. And, man, you could look back from Woodland Park, looking back towards Florissant to the west, and, man, it just looked like – it looks like the Mount St. Helens eruption or something. I mean, huge plume of smoke. Crazy, crazy, crazy. And then it became apparent that, man, we're not going to be allowed to go back. The fire department blocks those roads into those areas. It says, no way, you know, nobody can come back in there. So wild stuff. So we end up staying with friends in Woodland Park for two nights, man. And it was around this time, the second night, that I start thinking, that it occurs to me that I would not have perished. I would not have died had I remained to maybe grab a toothbrush and some underwear and a clean shirt. So yours truly, Phil, here, same boots, jeans, and shirt for about 3 or 4 days straight in the heat, bought a toothbrush, did buy a toothbrush. But crazy times, man. We just kind of killed time in Woodland Park with various people helping us out. But a wild scene to be sure. By about the second day, the huge plume of smoke was gone, but the fire was still there. You know, I got to go one of the fire meetings in Lake George with the fire department there, and all the planes and helicopters that were dumping all the retardant, and the helicopters were swooping down in Lake George with those 50-gallon buckets. It's like fighting World War II, man. Just bombing it. The fire chief's like, man, we're hitting it from the ground. We're chopping trees, dirt, water, hitting with water. We're coming in hard on the north side with the planes, with the water, with the retardant. You know, and then all this time they're investigating how it started. You know, there were arsonists. A lot of fires were being started by people. I don't know what kind of whack jobs were doing that and to what end, but wild times, man. And the winds were whipping. And, dude, if it's hot and dry and the winds are high, it is a recipe for disaster. They finally got that one. That was by the camp. That was, I knew there were fires everywhere else. And, boy, the day we were leaving, we were only there for 2 weeks anyway. day before we're leaving, I'm up on my cabin porch, sipping some coffee, as I am wont to do, when I gaze back to the east towards Colorado Springs and see another huge plume of smoke coming up, man. And that is what we're reading about today, the Waldo Canyon fire near the Garden of the Gods, the Air Force Academy, right there in Colorado Springs, which... we were going to drive to Colorado Springs, then head south to drive home the next day. And everyone was like, oh, the highway will be open. It's no big deal. It'll be one lane. But the morning we left, Sunday morning, all the roads were closed. They'd evacuated all the little towns between Woodland Park and Colorado Springs. So, man, a continuing very dangerous situation up there with the Waldo Canyon fire. Still raging on, and many others throughout the West. I'm really digesting this news, man. I find myself just going all over the internet looking for photos and news of the progress the firefighters are making and the planes and all that kind of stuff. So our thoughts and prayers, of course, go out to everybody in my beloved Colorado. We got so many great friends up there, and people we're pulling for. They're always going to be safe. It's amazing that these fires are just so destructive. But man, it's really impressive, or I was impressed with the police and firefighters, how they are very cool-headed in these meetings. They are not dictatorial and, they're not pushy or, they're not tyrants when they're getting you out of their homes. They're very sympathetic. So, hey man, we got to keep you guys out. We don't know which way this thing's going to do. Very transparent. They got maps of, the fire, and they tell you exactly what they're doing. And, you really feel like you're kind of helping the cause a little bit, and I was very impressed with how they did that. So Godspeed up there, folks. Fight those fires, get them out, and we'll pray for rain. Well, what do we have next? You know what? You know who loves Colorado and fishing that I've discovered? A great friend of mine through the years and a legend in the Texas music world, the great guitarist, dobroist, pedal steel guitarist Roger Ray from Jason Boland and the Stragglers Band for so many years. He's going to drop by here and share some of his thoughts on Colorado fishing, playing pedal steel guitar, and other things. So stay tuned. Special guest next, Roger Ray.
All I want to do is get back to what I'm good at. Back to what I do best. Back to what I know. The tall grass, away from concrete, away from stone.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. This is Phil Pritchett on the P2 Podcast. From beautiful Fort Worth, Texas, my beautiful studio here, Trinidad World Recording Studios, broadcasting to all four corners of the globe in beautiful high-definition audio, or something quite like it. Well, as promised, everyone, we had some Colorado fire talk here in our first segment, telling about the evacuation, Phil's adventures up there, all the things that entails. Who are we bringing here today? Who do I hear out in the kitchen rummaging through the refrigerator, knocking on the wrong doors, but a Texas legend himself? You know him from Jason Boland and the Stragglers, the most celebrated pedal steel player in this genre, it's fair to say. Is it not? We'll ask him ourselves. The great Roger Ray is here.
Hey, Phil, what's up?
Sitting on the IKEA sofa. It's going well, man. Well, man, this is something long in the works. Long in the works. The negotiations have just been going back and forth, a lot of ideas. Kind of, man, you got to get Roger on the show.
I'm glad to be here.
He's busy out there. So, man, here he is today coming in. We've done worked on a lot of records here of late and in the past. Yeah. Roger's a local guy that come by and throw down some dobro, pedal steel, what have you. We've done several things. You've done a lot of work here.
Yeah, I like it over here.
Now, where did you start playing? Did you come from a musical family?
Yeah, that's a good question. My dad played guitar, but he was in the Navy, so he played mostly just little dive bars and whatever as a hobby.
Where'd you grow up? Did you grow up here in Oklahoma?
I grew up in eastern Oklahoma.
Okay.
I actually was born on the East Coast, Jacksonville. My dad was still in the Navy.
Right.
Moved up and down the coast a few times.
A military family.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, at first. And then he retired and moved us all back to Oklahoma. And, you know, he always had a guitar or two laying around, so kind of grew up listening to music. Kind of thought everybody had a guitar laying around.
That was just part of the household.
That's right.
So you were one, even at a young age, to pick up the guitar.
I did. I wanted to play guitar.
Unlock the mysteries of it.
I did.
Yeah.
But instead of getting a guitar for Christmas one year, I don't know, I was probably 10 or 11 years old, I got a pedal steel guitar for Christmas. It was really my dad's...
cruel trick.
Yeah, he really wanted one for himself.
I see.
So he bought one, a beginner's model, and said, here you go, why don't you learn how to play this, because nobody plays these anymore.
Yeah.
Especially the kids or whatever. And so I tried to please the old man, and I tried to learn it, but man, it was hard.
That had to be hard without some working guitar, knowledge of strings and frets.
Theory,
and,
mostly.
I didn't know theory.
Right. You know, I would have been better off starting with piano or something and then moving to pedal steel.
Right.
So it was just so frustrating, I didn't play it for years.
Yeah.
And then I started playing guitar, much to his dismay. I bought my own guitar.
Yeah, a six-string, thanks to Santa. Acoustic or a...
Yeah, an old Fender acoustic was the first guitar I had. And then the first electric I had was one of those... I bought it brand new... was like an 80-something, the Strat, the Japanese Strat copy, the Buddy Holly guitar.
Okay, yeah,
Maple
right.
neck, you know, the
yeah,
two-tone.
Yeah, Sunburst.
That's the one.
Deal,
that's
yeah.
the one. The vintage, 57 vintage or whatever, not made in the USA.
Right.
The knockoff.
Yeah.
But that served me well for a while. So then I had an acoustic and electric going through high school.
So what were you listening to? You playing Iron
Back
Maiden
then,
and stuff?
Man, you know, I listened to all the stuff that you would listen to. All the 80s hairband stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Shredding. Working
but
on,
I didn't play
working on
stuff.
Your hammer ons and triplets.
Man, I didn't really play it. I listened
Not
to
really?
All the Guns N' Roses and stuff. I just didn't like it playing. I played country, but listened to the stuff that everybody else listened. You know, I played football, so you had to listen to all of the current trendy, motivational. Yeah.
Pre-game metal and stuff.
Yeah. Well, you listen to it now and it sounds like the oldies.
That's right.
You know? I mean, Warrant and Trickster and Firehouse just played the Glass Cactus last week.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Were you there?
A show. No, I was out of town, but I thought that is a show that I went to around 1990.
Yeah.
You know, I went to see that show.
Right.
In Fort Smith, Arkansas, the same bands. And here
really?
They are.
Maybe they all still have the same management or whatever.
I wanted to go to the Glass Cactus just to see the show, just to see if it brought back any old memories or some of those songs I hadn't heard. Some of the deep cuts.
Yeah.
I mean, Trickster. What's some deep cuts from Trickster, man? You know?
I can't even think of what their shallow cuts were.
The shallow cuts were, oh, man. That's a good question. They were all ballads, too. They picked up... Every other band that had the one or two ballads that ended up going number one, pop,
right.
whatever.
Yeah, the big power.
So you got Firehouse and Trickster and these other bands on the heels of the Motley Crue.
Right.
That went, oh, why don't we just make a whole album of ballads?
I know. Why mix it in?
Yeah.
So you're listening to metal.
I was listening to
God, this is confusing. So you're listening to hairband metal.
That's kind of what everybody listened to.
But where'd you get your concept of like country music, you had to be listening to something.
My dad was a huge country freak. Man.
So that was always playing. That's what he was playing.
Always,
yeah,
always.
Like the old school
he'd
stuff.
He'd get drunk on the weekends and play Merle Haggard and Lefty Frizzell all night long.
Yeah,
Johnny Cash.
Yeah,
you know. So I think part of listening to whatever was modern and contemporary at the time was a rebellious streak by saying, "Let's stop listening." Me and my brother,
right?
Let's stop listening to the old man's music and start listening to. Whatever, you know.
So what were some of the acts, though? You had to have really been inspired or fallen in love with some players or some bands or some acts. I mean, were there some that you,
you know,
I don't know, tried to emulate? God, man, this guy really
pretty
is
pretty much all in
amazing.
The country genre back
okay.
then.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Like I said, while I listened to what was popular,
right.
I always went back to trying to emulate and play the
studying
country
those
stuff.
Country guys.
Yeah,
like
the country
who?
Licks. Well, you know,
Merle Haggard.
Roy Nichols and...
Yeah.
I wasn't really into steel guitar then, though.
Yeah,
so
you're
it was
still
just
playing
guitar and Luther Perkins, basically Johnny Cash's guy,
right?
Who played simple but tasty.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I played, you know, Folsom Prison was probably the first lead I ever learned. Just that, you know, simple. That's it. Yeah. And now you listen to stuff like that and you think that is so elementary. You know, That's ridiculously elementary.
And yet, so right.
Back then, it just seemed like a good thing to start with as a kid. But then, you know, I met all the Texas Playboys because my dad was a Bob Wills just fanatic, and he would take us to these Texas Playboy
shows,
reunions.
Reviews.
Yeah. Kane's Ballroom or whatever, State Fair that featuring. Yep. So I met all these guys, and they were already kind of old timers to me because I was 12 or 13 years old. And met Eldon Shamlin and Leon McAuliffe and all those dudes. And I just remember Leon said to me, listen to your dad about the steel guitar thing. Don't you put the guitar away. Everybody plays guitar. And it just kind of stuck to me.
You don't need more guitar players.
Yeah. Later when I met Bolin, I still had that beginner's model steel guitar. It was a Zum steel, probably from the 60s. Three pedals that barely worked and a couple levers that didn't really work right. And, and when we recorded Pearl Snaps in 1999, that was the pedal steel that I used on that record.
Yeah.
And Lloyd Maines just kind of looked at it and he thought, oh my gosh, we'll see what we can get out of this thing. And I didn't really know how to play it.
Right.
And he told the other guys, go off and explore Austin today because I got to
work with the steel
teach
player.
This guy, I got to teach this guy a couple of licks.
Well, let's back up. So how did you first meet Jason Bolin? Where did that come to be?
We both had a mutual respect for some of the local songwriters around the Stillwater area.
But you knew him from where? From
Stillwater was where he was living. He was going to college.
Okay.
I'd already graduated from the other school in Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. I see. Bitter enemies.
But I was sneaking up to Stillwater because the music scene was better than Norman's.
Okay.
So
he was still in school at OSU.
He was in school at
You'd
OSU.
I graduated from OU. Okay.
A couple years prior.
Were you playing around Norman a little bit, meeting some guys?
I did when I was in college. But when I graduated, I didn't really have aspirations to play music professionally.
Right.
It was just a hobby.
Yeah.
I was actually an accountant for 5 years, you know? Yeah. And so,
unlikely story.
So I would do it on the weekends. You know, it would be the CPA thing for Monday through Friday. And I remember, like it was yesterday, driving to Stillwater, taking my suit and tie off as I'm heading up 35.
Yeah.
Like changing into jeans and a t-shirt so that I don't walk into Willie's Saloon with a tie on, right?
Right.
And then
chugging a few beers, trying to be somewhat musician-like by the time you showed up.
I think I felt older at 25 than I do now.
Right. probably so.
Yeah. But
So you knew that there were scenes up there. I mean, what was going on?
Yeah.
The Great Divide stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that was big. And then, of course, you had Cody and Canada and Ragweed was doing their thing.
Did Boland already have a band, or was he just kind of a singer?
He did not have a band. He would do like a...
Well, did someone tell you about him, or did you see him somewhere?
Well, Bob Childers was a guy that was kind of the guru songwriter up there.
Okay, yeah.
And I was playing some stuff with Beverly Mays, this lady that was a singer-songwriter back then, and just some Tom Skinner and Greg Jacobs. A lot of these guys, they were doing these records on Jeff Parker's label in Stillwater, Dust Bowl Records or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a big... There for a few years, there was kind of a red dirt folk thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really band-oriented. It was mainly songwriter-oriented.
Wormy Dog, etc. Was that part
Willie's
of the
Willie's Wormy Dog,
scene,
and there was a place called Ford's Alley in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And it was... I got some gigs just playing dobro or guitar on the side and whatever.
Just sitting in with guys.
Yeah, because that's all it was.
Messing around, right.
Yeah, and it was mostly older songwriters. And Bob said, you got to meet this guy named Jason Bolin. He's kind of a young, upcoming singer-songwriter in the scene.
Just getting going.
He needs a band, and you're looking for somebody, you know, to be in a band with. You guys are the same age.
Sure.
And so I finally met him at the farm in Stillwater, and we both knew who each other were because it was almost, you know, it was kind of one of those, you need to meet this guy, and you need to meet that guy. And
right.
So we just started kicking around the idea of playing some shows together, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, about a year later, I said, well, you know, I got this friend that plays bass that I grew up with. And he said, well, one of my fraternity brothers is a drummer. Let me give him a call. And we had our first rehearsal in 98.
Where was that?
At the Yellow House, where he lived,
mm-hmm.
which went on to become an infamous place. I mean,
late night jams, etc.
Just think about all the people that lived there. Stoney LaRue lived there for a while. Cody Canada lived there for a while. I mean, it was just...
Was this a house near the campus somewhere?
Right on campus.
Okay.
Big old yellow five-bedroom house called the Yellow House. Yeah. Walking distance to the strip there. It was the place.
Yeah. Before and after the bars closed, you know.
Open door policy, you just never knew. I mean, strangers would just walk in there.
Yeah.
You know.
Cool, man. So y'all had like some gear set up in the living room?
Off and on. Yeah.
So you started playing some of the first, just finding some common ground on covers and stuff like
pretty
that.
Pretty much Keen covers, Jeff Walker covers. We were pretty enamored with Texas back then.
Sure.
The Oklahoma, I mean, even the Norman scene.
What struck you about Boland early on? Anything? Or you kind of like, he seems like a nice guy, if nothing else.
Man, I played with a bunch of different indie pop kind of stuff in college when I was at OU. And I had some good friends, you know. We played a lot of shows, actually. But it didn't really stick because most of the original stuff wasn't the stuff that I liked.
Right, it wouldn't.
I mean, these are guys that didn't know who Townes Van Zandt was. It was just, you know, like, think Dave Matthews.
Right.
Before Dave Matthews was, you know. Yeah, I remember just doing Dave Matthews covers before anybody even knew who Dave Matthews was.
Right,
those kind
of
things.
Yeah.
So it didn't really move me, but it was fun to play. It was fun to get out, and you know, when you're 20 years old, it's just fun to go to the bar and play music, right?
Sure.
But then when I met Boland, I thought, man, this is actually music I would listen to.
Yeah.
So
he was a real writer's writer kind of guy.
Yeah.
Like he wasn't all about.
And it
know.
Was more in the country genre.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I owned a pedal steel, you know, made it a little bit different. Not that I played it very much in the beginning, but
so you started practicing your
I did.
Pedal steel
stuff. I did. I started practicing to be a country player.
Yeah,
you know, it was always my hobby.
That had to have just taken just hours upon days
still
and years.
I still don't know how to play that thing.
Yeah,
it's still intimidating.
It's sort of what I always say. Where great guitar players get bored, they start messing with the pedal steel. You know,
it's a challenge, man.
It is. It's sort of. Gosh, there's so much to it, man. It's a mysterious instrument.
Multiple things going on.
So y'all started playing a lot of gigs around Stillwater, mainly?
We did, mostly Oklahoma. Stillwater, mm-hmm. Tulsa, Oklahoma City. We did that for about a year until we made that first record.
Yeah.
Once we made the first record...
How'd y'all end up in Austin making the record? Is that where y'all made it?
Lloyd, yeah.
Cedar Creek?
We were going to use Lloyd Maines no matter what because...
He'd done
the Great Divide stuff.
Sure.
And we just knew we were too green to make our own record.
Right.
And it would be wasted money... to do something local.
Trying to pull something off in a garage.
So what we did was, we went to the four richest people we knew and borrowed $5,000 each, basically.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, it was a Kickstarter, except in person.
Yeah, right, right. Back before the days of Kickstarter.
Yeah, back when you had to talk to
people. So y'all did? I mean, just collectively raised about...
We raised about $20,000, and that paid for the studio time, the pressing... And the way it worked out, in my mind, I thought if we sell 2,000,
the accountant in you was just racking up the totals.
Man. That's right. I thought if we sell the first pressing, then from then on out, you know, we're basically
gravy. Print your own money.
That's right. That's right. And we did. I thought it would take a couple of years. I think maybe in 8 months or so, we sold the first.
Did y'all hire some radio publicity people, or not really?
We didn't because we didn't know to. In fact, back then, the infrastructure, especially in Oklahoma, unlike Texas, mm-hmm. was very disorganized. You didn't get radio play no matter what.
Sure. What year was this, 90?
This is 2000.
2000.
Pearl Snaps came out in 2000.
So you had, and plus you were still in a market where it was still, even at that time, cool to have a CD.
Sure. Absolutely.
It still wasn't like,
every
guy and his dog's got a record.
That's right.
It was still like, ooh.
Man, we recorded that first
one
on analog, 2-inch tape.
Yeah. Oh, did you really? Oh, it's Cedar Creek.
So, we didn't know. They didn't have a Pro Tools environment yet.
Yeah.
So, it was still Fred Reverend spinning the old 2-inch tape, band punches.
Old Neve board and all that in there.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
It was great. And, you know, we're going back to that on this next record that we're going to do.
Is that right?
Yeah. Boland, he went back and he's been listening pretty hardcore to the sonic, you know, qualities of the records we've done over the years. I think we've done 8.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody likes that first one, but nobody can really tell you why. Is it the writing? Is it the innocence? Whatever.
Yeah.
Even today, the most requested songs at our shows are from the very first record, you know, over 10 years ago.
Me too. I hope that makes you feel better. Yeah. It's like, but those 10 songs, we still play them every night, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So.
But sonically, there's something about that record that just sounds good. It's just warm. And we were just too green to even know what the hell we were doing.
Right.
So it couldn't have been the skills.
right. Yeah.
It certainly wasn't the skills.
So you're going to try to marry that old sonic quality with what you've learned now
as writers and musicians. That's the goal.
That's the idea. So y'all are planning on doing something soon? Are y'all already working on something?
Yeah, probably in August. We're going to go in and we're going to just cut.
If you don't mind my asking, do y'all have a Do y'all still raise the money and do it yourself kind of thing, or is there another party involved at
now,
this stage?
We did one record on Sustain Records.
Uh-huh.
A guy named Jimmy Perkins. And,
yeah.
You know, he kind of, I don't think with any ill intention, we just kind of got shafted on the mm-hmm. record because it just cost too much to do. We did it with Pete Anderson and mm-hmm. flew out to Burbank. And, man, I don't know that we ever recouped the money spent for that record. It was just, it became a bad idea.
Right.
To think these labels aren't doing anything for us. I mean, they're doing something for somebody, I'm sure, or they wouldn't exist, but we're much better off just paying for them as we go.
Sure.
There's just, you know.
When the first one sells, the money comes back into your deck.
It's grassroots. You know what? Right. We don't get national attention, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know what we do. We're stuck in this blue collar mentality, putting out records and going on the road. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just strange to me when someone says, stick with it and y'all will make it.
You're like, there's nowhere for us to go. Yeah.
would
you say that to James McMurtry or anybody like that? I'm
right.
Like, there's, you know, how much bigger could he get? I'm like,
would you go to a fourth grade teacher and say, stick with it and you'll make it?
Yeah.
One day you'll be teaching at Harvard.
Making $100,000. It's just like, man, you either love doing it and
that's
this
right.
is what it pays or not.
That's exactly it. That's it.
Well, Roger Ray is here on the IKEA sofa. What a treat, folks. Finally, the day has come. We've talked about it before. Hopefully he will rejoin us next week, maybe the week after. So many stories to tell from his time playing pedal steel with Boland. Oh, man, he's an avid fisherman, avid fly fisherman. I wanted to get into details with him in the coming weeks about that. So thanks for coming by, Roger.
Hey, man, thanks for having me.
We hope to see you here real soon.
All right.
Well, folks, that is our show for this week, the Pizzu Podcast. Are you still listening to that Pritchett Live record from Corpus Christi? Go get it. It's on iTunes along with the entire catalog. And if you want us to come play at your house, your living room, your swimming pool, your club, your ranch, wherever, man, phil@philpritchett.com. Shoot me an email. We love it. My thanks to Roger Ray for being here today.
Thank you,
talking with us. We'll see you next week, folks. Be good to each other out there. Much tougher.